Now we get to talk about Bereshit. So last week, as we reflected on Sukkot and Simchas Torah, we kept coming back to the message that we need to open to the teachings of the natural world. After 40 days of intense self-reflection during the month of Elul and the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we have dissolved some of the partitions within our self-awareness, and we may discover, as Rumi says in his poem, The Guest House, within ourselves, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. And then, following these days of self-reflection, as if we are putting on a play of this 13th century Sufi mystic's poem, we set up a sukkah, a shelter that is an illusion of a house that keeps nothing out, that has to be part of the natural world so that we can see the stars through the organic material that forms a very permeable and impermanent roof. Through the holiday cycle, we learn that we will always feel insecure if we just focus on building stronger walls to protect ourselves from unwanted visitors, whether those visitors are uncomfortable feelings that arise within or other people who come to visit. However, when we reconnect with ourselves, with others, and with the natural world, we may find moments of being able to rest in the unfolding of being. In our celebration of the cyclical nature of life on Simchat Torah, we read the last verses of Dvarim and immediately start the first verses of Bereshit. The Torah ends as Moses climbs to the top of Mount Nebo so he can take in the whole vista of the land he can't enter. He dies there, and God, God's self, buries Moses, who becomes again part of the earth in a place unmarked by any stone, truly returning to become one with the natural world, a green burial, we would say. And then we immediately turn to read the opening lines of Bereshit, where we learn that humans come from that very same earth, the very same elements to which Moses has returned. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh created Adam from the dust of the earth, Adama. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh blew into Adam's nostrils, blew Nishmat Chaim, the breath of life, into Adam to make him a living being. And this human, created as one with nature, is perfectly nourished by the garden God created for him and is free to eat the fruit of every tree except for the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And thus unfolds the story of how humans became alienated from the natural world, expelled from the garden where they had been at one with nature, and the rest of the Torah addresses in one way or another, the desperate question that comes up, how to get back to the garden, how to get back to a state of oneness. So the Torah describes the journey that each of us takes from our emerging into this world, first as a physical being, and then as a knowing being through our gaining knowledge of good and bad, through our disappointment, despair, and searching for meaning of life, and for connection to a source of creativity and vitality, and finally, a return to oneness with nature. So with the help of Rabbi Jeff Roth's commentary on Bereshit, which is informed by his study of Jewish mystical writings, I'll focus today on a way of understanding the eating from the tree of knowledge of good and bad as a metaphor for what happens when we consume and get filled up with a way of knowing the world that depends on categories and concepts, on divisions and separations. What happens when we overvalue verbal explanations and don't pay as much attention to the nonverbal wisdom we began to acquire immediately at birth or even before? What happens when we force our perception of the world into categories, rather than taking in the rich and ever-changing complexity of reality as it is unfolding? How did words, mere descriptions, become so powerful when they can't really contain or express the whole embodied experience of being alive? And how does meditation practice point us in the direction of returning to the garden? So once again, we're supported in our inquiry both by the rich Kabbalistic commentary on Bereshit and by Thich Nhat Hanh's commentary on the Buddhist story of creation, often called the 12 Steps of Dependent Origination. There are two main differences between these two different commentaries on creation. Bereshit, at least on the surface of the story, is the story of the creation of the world and humankind long ago, while the 12 Steps of Dependent Origination provide an explanation of how everything is constantly coming into being in each moment. It's not about something that happened long ago, but what's happening in each moment. Another difference is the step that we call knowledge of good and bad in Bereshit is called ignorance, or not seeing, avidya rather than vidya. However, with the help of Daniel Matt's translation of the Zohar, Rabbi Jeff Roth gives us an interpretation of Bereshit that highlights how the particular type of knowledge represented by that bite in the apple is indeed a form of ignorance, of not seeing, not understanding. Now, you can read all the details and references to the Kabbalistic commentary in Jeff's book, Me, Myself, and God, or you can listen to his 50-minute talk that can be found as a podcast on the Awakened Heart Project website, and it's called The Tree of Life and the Fundamental Problem of Human Existence. That was from April 2014. It was given at the Jewish Meditation Teacher Training Session, maybe the one that we attended, I can't recall. But a brief summary of the main message is that knowledge or understanding is not a problem in itself, but the particular kind of knowledge that we became greedy to acquire when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge of good and bad is a knowledge based on separation and division, on seeing things as distinct rather than interconnected. So Rabbi Jeff Roth calls upon the Kabbalistic interpretation of Bereshit to explain how the bite of the apple led to exile. In this cosmology, the world came into being through the emanations of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, represented by the Sphirot. He explains that when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge, they ruptured its perfect union with the tree of life, rupturing the connection between Shekhinah, also known as Malchut, the indwelling presence of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in this world, and Tiferet, which we can translate as divine compassion. A knowledge that depends on seeing things as separate, not interconnected, leads to a consciousness that causes suffering and expulsion from the previous state of being at one with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in the Garden of Eden. Now, if the Kabbalistic symbols are not helpful, we can turn to some of the basic mindfulness teachings that echo the same understanding, that language, the source of so much creativity and innovation, the way we communicate with others, we're here gathered today because of language, that connect us to each other can also lead to suffering. For example, once we call ourselves selves, we start believing there is a separate, solid, enduring entity that we have to maintain. I am strong, I am intelligent, I'm capable, I'm a helpful friend. And then when we see these impermanent features changing, we have an identity crisis, a cause for suffering. we feel we are in exile from the source of divine compassion. It is only when we can experience ourselves as a part of a continuous flow of life and relationships that are constantly changing in response to changing conditions that we can accept life's changes with less suffering. A similar message comes from the Buddhist scriptures that are illuminated by Thich Nhat Hanh and summarized by Norman Fisher in a series of talks he gave to the Everyday Zen community that are on the Everyday Zen website. He has a series of 7 talks on the heart of the Buddha's teachings, which was written by Thich Nhat Hanh. The Buddha's creation story is a story of how experience is created in every moment. It's the story of the ongoing process of creation that contributes to our experience of suffering in life. In these lives of exile that we lead, the same problem described in Bereshit of being exiled from interconnectedness. The Buddhist story of creation, which Thich Nhat Hanh calls the 12 links of interdependent co-arising, is also known as dependent origination. And they answer the question, what are the conditions necessary for something to come into existence? It's a way to understand how the human mind relates to the world. And from this perspective, what we call knowledge is actually called ignorance or not seeing. Not seeing the interconnectedness of everything. And it grows out of the Buddha's simple observation that's described in these words. This is because that is, and this is not because that is not. This comes to be because that comes to be. This ceases to be because that ceases to be. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, this table contains the carpenter, time, skillfulness. The wood needs the forest, the sunshine, the rain, and so on. The carpenter needs his parents, breakfast, fresh air, and so on. Each is brought about by other conditions. Eventually, we'll see that everything in the cosmos has come together to bring us this table. That the one can be seen in the all, and the all can be seen in the one. Every cause is an effect, and every effect is also the cause of something. Cause and effect inter are, in Thich Nhat Hanh's language of interbeing. Now, to truly benefit from the Dharma, Thich Nhat Hanh explains, we have to have teachings that help us enter the space that lies outside of the conceptual realm, outside of the realm in which we believe, for example, that self is a solid, separate thing. The 12 links describe our usual process of perception and interpretation of reality, and how this leads to unskillful action. The first step in these 12 steps is avidya, not seeing clearly, the absence of understanding. The second link is the object of our perception. As far as the deluded mind is concerned, these objects we perceive are separate entities. When there's wisdom, explains Thich Nhat Hanh, we see that these objects that we perceive actually depend on each other. The third link is consciousness. It's important to understand that the function of consciousness is to discriminate the perceiver from the object that is perceived and to make the objective world seem to be separate from the observer. Well, of course we think, of course, my mind, my ability to perceive is separate from this flower that I'm perceiving. However, I have to bring in some of the research in cognitive neuroscience on the process of perception. That we usually see what we think we're going to see. Our expectations and predictions heavily color the way our minds interpret what we perceive. Often, we actually disregard the information from our sense organs, so we can hold on to our previous belief about how the object really is. So we never really see a flower that is just out there, separate from our complex perceiving and comparing mind and its expectations. Of course, this form of consciousness that we have is nevertheless a wonderful, productive thing that has created great civilizations, afforded us wonderful art and spiritual practices, comfortable, safe homes, and shelter from a stormy world. But the way we perceive everything is separate from ourselves. The way we lack understanding of the interconnectedness of everything has also led to great suffering, cruelty, war, and of course, blindness to the impact of our way of living on the natural world. So both the Kabbalists and the early Buddhists recognized the great gift of knowledge to discriminate between good and bad, to see things as separate. And yet it also contains in it the path to exile from non-conceptual space. And it is only when we are able to enter into this non-conceptual space that we can experience the oneness of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, or the interbeing described by Thich Nhat Hanh. Both creation stories have the same message, that our deluded way of understanding the world leads to suffering, exile, and alienation. So if all this is too cerebral, I'll end with a couple of pithy Zen sayings that have the same message. One of my favorite is, open your mouth and you're wrong. Another is, don't mistake the finger pointing at the moon for the moon. And of course, in everyday life, one saying that we have will be familiar to you. How many times have we tried to describe something that was an amazing experience? And we're telling that to someone, and then we look at the face of the listener and this unimpressed expression, and we say, well, you had to be there. Attending a concert by your favorite artist is not the same as listening to the songs in your car. It's not the same as reading the words and notes of the sheet music. And it's not the same as the feeling of singing the song by yourself. It's wonderful to have sheet music so everyone can learn the words and the music. But it's not the same as the experience of being there surrounded by the sounds, sights, and physical sensations, of being present with the entire experience as it unfolds. Words cannot capture the whole body experience of being there, nor of being alive right now, here, in this moment.